Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, that's the end of the 90 minutes. It will be extra time. We hope you'll stay with us.
Good afternoon and welcome to Ness and Dormer Extra Time. This is our little offshoot where we take a broader look around the world of football and particularly football writing. My name's Mike Gibbons and today we're going to be talking to Jonathan O'Brien, a professional editor and writer for the Sunday Post in Ireland, whose writing has also appeared in the Irish Independent, the Sunday Tribune and When Saturday Comes. Jonathan's just published his first book called Euro Summits, the story of the UEFA European Championship 1960 to 2016. As you may have guessed from the subtitle, it's the entire history of UEFA's flagship international tournament, timed for release ahead of the rescheduled Euros, which starts shortly and available now from Pitch Publishing. Jonathan O'Brien, hello.
Hello, Mike. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Good. So, just to start, I mean, one thing I'd like to say is when I heard that you were doing this book, I was really, really pleased to see this idea come to fruition, because the World Cup has had a couple of definitive histories. You know, Chris Freddie's done one, Brian Glanville's done one, but there's never been one up until now about the European Championships, and I've always felt it's a topic that needed to be covered. Did you have similar feelings? Is that why you chose to write this?
Yeah, I did, as a matter of fact. I know that Chris Freddie started one, but never got it finished. Some of it turned up on UEFA's website about 20 years ago, but it's all now long gone. I would have certainly bought one like a flash if he'd done one, because he's a fantastic writer and a nice guy as well. But I can pinpoint the exact date when I started working on this thing. It was Stevens' Day, or Boxing Day, as you guys call it, 2014, and I was up late. The wife had gone to bed. So I stuck on some football on DVD player. Remember them DVD players? and I was watching a bit of Euro 92. And I was just sitting there and thinking, is there a book about this stuff? Someone should do something about it. And I went searching the following day online. And to my absolute surprise, there was nothing in print. There was a Kindle job, but it was a bit different from the one I've now ended up doing. It was a bit shorter. So I kept looking anyway, and I found there was one done in French and one published in Germany. And apparently the German one was a big seller, but nothing in the English language market in print. So I thought to myself, this is a huge gap in the market. And I think, this is the third biggest sporting event in the world, really, behind the World Cup and the Olympics. And it beggars belief to me that there was nothing done about this before. That weekend, I just started on. I did some stuff about 92. I think the first match I did was the Dutch beating the Germans 3-1 in Gothenburg, an absolutely fabulous game. And I knocked about 5,000 words out of that. Now, obviously, that came down considerably later on. But it was just on a roll. And within about 2 years, I had pretty much the whole thing done. And then the next 3 years were spent sort of trying to get it into print and also hacking it down and correcting things as I went. I edit stuff for a living at the Business Post newspaper, and that came in very handy when I was writing this book. Like initially it was way longer, as I've said, it was about 360,000 words that had to come right down, and it had far too much stuff in it that wasn't quite that relevant. It was initially just match reports and nothing else. It needed more color and more stories, more off the field stuff. And Pitch got me to slash it down to 170,000, which was a big blessing in disguise, as it turned out. I think it's a better book for it. It's much more streamlined. You've got to strike a balance between the nerdy anorex stuff and the off-field stories, and also a balance of getting everything of relevance in while not boring the reader to tears. That's the golden rule of writing, as far as I'm concerned. Don't waste the reader's time.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's an enormous thing to take on. I mean, it's... Was it 15 tournaments over?
Yeah, it's about 300 matches. But it jumping from 31 matches to 51 didn't help, although I'll get to that later. But it was so much fun to do. Like, I mean, the only time it remotely felt like hard work was I sat down and watched the 1968 semi-final between England and Yugoslavia in Florence.
Oh, yeah.
And it was possibly the dirtiest game I've ever seen. But worse even than that, it was incredibly boring. It felt like doing penance watching this thing. I almost put the DVD in the bin when I finished. It was that bad. And that was if you read that particular page in the book, you can see my boredom and barely suppressed anger coming out as I wrote it. But other than that, it's just such a blast to go through all these old matches and see stuff you'd completely forgotten about and names you hadn't heard in decades. It was just huge fun. Didn't feel like work in the slightest apart from that one thing.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't seen that match ever, but I've read about it, and I think there's something like 60 fouls in it. So it's like one every 90 seconds or something. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, you get the English perspective. Obviously, they're going to side with their own team, but now, obviously, I'm an Irishman and I'm not that mad about the England team. But I do have to say, watching that game, I thought England were slightly the dirtier of the two teams.
Yeah.
There's an awful incident in the first couple of minutes where Ivica Osim, who later managed Yugoslavia at Italia 90, he was their playmaker back then. And Norman Hunter just comes up to him and just absolutely disembowels him nearly. And there was no substitutes in those days. And Osim had to stay on the field. He could barely walk, never mind run. There was also a player on the Yugoslavian team called Dobrivoje Trivic, who again just wandered around the pitch all night just kicking people and didn't get sent off. He provoked Alan Mullery at the end. But it was a dreadful, dreadful match and a dreadful tournament in general. I think it was easily the worst of all of 1968. Everyone always says 1980, but 1980 had a couple of good games and it had Bernd Schuster.
Yeah.
1968 had nothing really.
So on to the tournament then. I mean, it got a comparatively late start. If you think of it, you know, the Copa America and the World Cup and like the Africa Cup of Nations, they all got going before the European Championship. I mean, why did it take so long to get off the ground? And you know, why do you think its early editions were, you know, quite modest affairs, these little 14 tournaments?
Well, obviously the man behind the whole thing was Henri Delaunay, and he was quite sick. He died about 7 years before the first one kicked off in 1960. He died in 1953. His son took over from him at UEFA and kind of kept the whole thing rolling. The opening chapter of the book, there's a lot of stuff about that, about the endless meetings. And a lot of the national associations were very, they're just very suspicious of it. England sat out the first one. So did Italy. So did the Germans. The Germans sat out the first two.
Yeah.
West Germany were managed by Sepp Herberger at the time, and he was implacably opposed to this thing. The Germans didn't enter it until Helmut Schön took over from him after I can't remember what year Schön came in. Was it 66 or 65? Not sure. But anyway, Herberger hated the whole idea. And as it turned out, it blew up in his face because West Germany went off to the World Cup in Chile in 62. having played only four competitive matches in 2 years, which were the qualifiers against, I think, Yugoslavia and Northern Ireland. And they ended up in the quarterfinals and they were rusty as hell. And actually it was Yugoslavia who beat them, not in the qualifiers, my mistake. But they'd only played four games of competitive football in the previous 2 years. And if they'd gone into the first Euros, they would have been tournament tuned to a much bigger degree. England sat out the first one as well. Then they went into it and they got France in the final qualifiers. And Alf Ramsey went over to Paris and picked a team with five forwards. And England were annihilated on the day, 5-2. I think Ron Springett was in goal and he had a very, very bad game. And that result, it knocked England out. I think the second leg at Wembley ended 0-0. And it changed the course of English football history, actually, because Ramsey was never half as cavalier as that again. There was always a layer of defensiveness in big games where England were concerned. He never tried anything like that again. So you could say it had a big impact on the future shaping of English football.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the features of the book, I think, because particularly earlier editions of the Euros are less, you know, popularized in modern football, right? And I think there's a lot of hidden treasure in this book in terms of, you know, teams and stories that haven't had this kind of coverage before. Even up to, you know, like the great West German team in 1972, Panenka, I mean, people know about the penalty, but I don't think they really know about the background of it and, you know, where it came from and things like that. I mean, is that one of the things you're looking to get over in this book?
Yeah, absolutely. Personally, myself, I knew nearly nothing about the first three tournaments when I started writing this book. So for me, that was a dive into the unknown. They were pretty modest tournaments, but there were some interesting stories in them. Like, for instance, Spain drew the Soviet Union in the quarterfinals of the first one in 1960. And General Franco just simply didn't like the idea of having to play a home leg against these guys, these communist Bolsheviks, with the Soviet flag flying at the Bernabeu and the national anthem ringing out. Mm-hmm. And he effectively just ordered the Spanish FA to pull out of the competition. And UEFA should have slapped them with a large ban, but didn't do anything. The players were all primed and ready to go. They were about to board a flight and they were told, no, that it's off, which they were very angry about. Franco basically thought that there was a good chance Spain would lose and lose badly. So this obviously wasn't an option from his point of view in terms of propaganda purposes. 4 years later, Spain hosted the thing and ended up playing the Soviets in the final. Now, obviously, they couldn't duck out of that, and they did win it. But the Soviet players reported afterwards that it was a very intimidating atmosphere afterwards. There was a lot of just bad feeling, they thought, as they were waiting around to get their silver medals. But, you can imagine what would happen to a national team's FA if they pulled out of a big game, you know, with a week's notice or a few days' notice. They would have the book thrown at them. But back then, it was a very, very different story. It was different times. And the Spanish FA was very powerful regionally in UEFA. So that's why UEFA did nothing. As regards the event as a whole, I think it only really got going in 72 with the Germans. The German football public themselves regard the 72 team as the best they've ever had. And after watching, I watched their four games against England twice and then Belgium and the USSR. And I have to agree. I think overall they were the best team ever to win the Euros. They had about five world-class players and six excellent players. It was just pure quality in every single position. They didn't have a weak link. Watching them in the final against the USSR in Brussels, the USSR were a very strong outfit themselves. They had a lot of good players. And the Germans simply broke them over their knee. It could have been 8-0 or 9-0 very easily. The Soviet keeper, Yevhen Rudakov, had a stormer, and he had to, because it would have been an absolute humiliation otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really love about the Euros is that players can really build a reputation here internationally if they haven't had the chance or haven't done it at the World Cup. I mean, Gunter Netz would be the kind of classic example of from out of that 72 team. Whereas conversely, you know, someone like Johan Cruyff, I think he only played one game in the Euros, didn't he, in 1976? And had that sort of set to with Clive Thomas and all of that. But I do love this tournament for that, in that it's a kind of alternative way of making your name in international football, I think. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, there's certain players who did. Now, it's not so much the case anymore because the Euros has become such a big corporate event. But certainly back in the day, there were a lot of players who sparkled in the Euros, but for one reason or another didn't shine in a World Cup or didn't get to. Someone like Rui Jordão of Portugal, who scored twice in the semi-final in 84, the late Rui Jordão, he'd be a good example. Also, Schuster's the classic example. He only played in two games himself in 1980, but he was absolutely brilliant in both of them against the Dutch and the Belgians. And for various reasons, not only did he never play in a World Cup, he didn't play in another Euro. I think he missed 84 because he skipped the qualifier to be at the birth of his daughter, and the DFB didn't like that, so that was the end of him. But he's a great example of somebody who, if he'd done what he did in the Euros in a World Cup, he'd be even more famous. Not that he's obscure, obviously, he's pretty famous, but yeah, I think certainly in the old days there was a bit of that. The World Cup would give you a bigger platform, but I don't think that's been true since probably about the mid-90s.
Yeah. So, I mean, the tournament's gradually expanded, and I think this is a kind of expansion that reflects not just the changing map of Europe, but also the kind of importance of the tournament itself. And you touched a bit earlier on politics, you know, with Franco and the Soviet Union, but that is a backdrop to this tournament, isn't it, in the way that it's developed over time. And it's amazing to think that as late as 1992, still an 18 tournament.
UEFA's hand, I should say, was forced because, well, first of all, Yugoslavia had to sit that one out because of the war, and Denmark, as we know, came in and won it on the hoof. But following that, of course, the Soviet Union had broken up about 6 months earlier. Czechoslovakia then split in two peacefully, and of course all the Yugoslav republics themselves peeled off as well in the wake of the civil war. So UEFA's membership jumped by about 17 or 18 countries. And so from that moment on, you had bigger qualifying groups. Like in the old days, it wasn't uncommon to have three teams in a group. Now you had five, six, seven. I think one of the groups for Euro 2008 had eight teams in it. It was the group that Poland and Portugal came out of, I think. And of course, in that same group, Azerbaijan and Armenia refused to play each other, which I suppose cut down on the fixture load, if nothing else. But there was a lot of criticism when it went from 8 to 16 teams. But I think it was a good move overall, because while there may not be 16 really good teams in Europe, there's certainly more than 8. So, and yeah, also 16 has a square root, so there's none of this messing around with the four best third place teams, which is a thing I absolutely hate. I think it's a god awful format. It was used at Mexico 86, Italia 90, and USA 94, and a couple of those were good World Cups in spite of that. But it's a shocking format. Like in 2016, Albania beat Romania at the end of the group, and then had to sit around for the best part of a week, I think, to find out if they'd gone through or not, and then I think in another group, Turkey beat the Czech Republic 2-0, and this pushed Northern Ireland through. Like it's just, it goes against the whole sort of competitive element of the event. I think it's you're relying on other people in different groups to do you favors. I don't like that at all.
So one feature I've always liked about the Euros is it's always produced really, well, not always, but it has produced real left field winners, you know, like Czechoslovakia and Denmark and Greece. And it just, that seems to happen in a way that it just doesn't happen in the World Cup. I mean, I think probably the most left field winner of the World Cup is England, I would think.
You're possibly right. You've had the occasional surprise finalist in the World Cup, but like Croatia last time, but mostly that's been in the pre-war World Cups or the 50s or whatever, with Sweden getting to the final or whoever. It's produced at least four surprise winners. As you say, the Danes, the Greeks, Czechoslovakia in 76, and they nearly did it again in 96. And even last time out, Portugal, I don't think anyone really saw that coming at the outset. The other flip side of that is, with very few exceptions, there's this, a level of quality control in the European Championships that you don't really get in World Cup. Like, I think the biggest win in the World Cup is 10-1 for Hungary against El Salvador that time in 82. There's been a couple of 9-0s. There's been a few 8-0s. The biggest win in Euros history is 6-1, and that was the Dutch against Yugoslavia.
Quarter final,
yeah. And Sweden beat Bulgaria 5-0 in 2004. Now, those are obviously heavy beatings, but they're nowhere near 8-0, 9-0, 10-1. If you look back through the Euros, it's very, very difficult to find teams who qualified for it who were massively out of place and had no business there. Ireland in Euro 2012, sad to say, from my point of view, would be one of them. They were just completely out of their depth. Denmark in 2000 were well off the pace. But there's not been that too many others, really, has there?
No, not that I can... Not that I can think of. I've never thought about that actually until you brought that up. I mean, so is there one particular edition of the tournament that you'd say, where it's for whatever reason, whether it's for the quality of play or the importance or because it changed the dynamic of the tournament, that you would say is the greatest ever European Championship?
Well, to me there's two. I mean, I was 8 in 1984, and I love it for nostalgia reasons, and not just the brilliant games, but also things like the tango ball and the various Adidas kits and the phone line commentary. But if I had to pick one, I would say it was 2000. It was just wonderful. I had just started out as a journalist, and I was covering this thing for one particular paper, and it was just like, you knew it was going to be good from the start, because the opening match was Belgium and Sweden. And you would think that's a real meat and potatoes pairing, if ever there was one, you know. And it was a great game. I remember it was a Friday night, and I was sitting there watching. I was like, Jesus, if the rest of it is like this, we're onto a winner, you know. And there was just no let up from there. It was just brilliant match after brilliant match. And it had the one thing you want most from a tournament, which is great players proving it, great players stepping up to the mark. USA 94 was a bit like that too. People already established as world-class individuals emphasizing it again and again. You'd Zidane, you'd Figo, you'd Kluivert had a great tournament. Francesco Totti, for the only time in his career really, he looked absolutely world-class throughout that. And there was a great angle to it as well, in the sense that all the teams that were playing ugly, dull, sort of cautious football or just weren't very good, they all went home early, without exception. Norway, horrible to watch, knocked out by Alfonso Perez, getting that last minute goal for Spain against Yugoslavia. England were pretty diabolical, apart from a good 20 minutes against Portugal. They went home. The Germans, less said the better, you know. So it was great from that point of view. The teams that weren't really trying to play football got shunted out as quick as possible, and you were left with a last stage that was really, really good. And even in the final, like, Italy played very well, but it would have been kind of a shame, I think, if they'd won. I've nothing against Italy at all. I think they're great a lot of the time. But if they had won it with just that little tap in early in the second half by Marco Del Vecchio, I think it would have been kind of a shame, because the final always affects how we think of a tournament in retrospect, I think. Like, look at 2004. It's quite a bright tournament, lots of good games. But the Greeks won it. And again, no harm to the Greeks. They were doing what they had to do. But it means we remember 2004 a little bit less affectionately than we might otherwise have. You know what I mean? And so in 2000, I thought it was just great that France just came back with literally the last kick of the game and managed to save it. I mean, obviously, it's rough on Italy. I mean, one of the enduring images of that tournament, if you ever look back at it, as soon as Wiltord scores the equaliser, the camera cuts to the Italian bench, and they've all slumped down into the dugout except for Antonio Conte, who's just leaning against it with this look of absolute desolate despair in his eyes. I can see it now. I'll never forget it. It was almost like a morality play, nearly, that whole tournament. It was great. It was just belting from start to finish.
Yeah, I remember Italy getting through in the semis, actually. That was an extraordinary semi-final with the Dutch, who were, you know, one of the co-hosts, and all those missed penalties. They shouldn't really have been in the final to start with. I think they went down to nine men as well, didn't they? There was a couple of sendings on.
Yeah, I remember being really angry about that result on the day. I was sitting in my editor's office watching it on his screen because I had to file about 900 words about it that evening. And I remember being pissed off. But again, as with the Greeks in 2004, Italy were just doing what they had to do because, by and large, their players weren't as good as the Dutch. And that, funnily enough, they should have actually won it twice. Del Vecchio was through twice on Van der Sar and missed both chances. There was a lot of stuff talk after that match about the eternal immaculacy of Italian defending and blah blah blah. But in the end, I mean, they gave away two penalties. They had a man sent off for persistent fouling. The Dutch hit the post a couple of times, and there was other things. So it wasn't exactly a masterclass. It was a very brave effort, but it's been a little overpraised over the years, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you completely on Euro 84 as well. Actually, I mean, that's a tournament. It's got a really strange place in football history in the UK, because it wasn't televised in the UK particularly, because none of the home nations had qualified. I think most of our ITV and BBC were in Brazil covering England doing a South American tour when John Barnes scored his goal in the Maracanã. It virtually made no headlines, but it was this. So they had this brilliant Denmark team that had put England out.
Yeah,
that were just set kind of on fire. France, you know, he had the Puttini, the kind of, I guess it's the Euros equivalent of Maradona in 86. Just that, you know, he was so involved in everything, wasn't he? And he's such an important figure in the Euros, I think, Puttini, as a player and a manager. And then, you know, Ratti is now disgraced administrator, but, you know, he's the one who pushed the expansion to 24, wasn't he? And
I start off the book by sort of doing a sort of little profile of Platini and Henri Delaunay, and just trying to contrast them. Yeah, Platini, he occupies a singular place, I think, in the tournament's history. I think if there's one individual you had to pick out who dominated the event like no other, it's definitely him. He still holds the record for the amount of goals at a finals. It's nine. He took only five games to do that. Cristiano Ronaldo holds the record jointly with him. But Ronaldo took about, I think, four tournaments to do it, and he's played about 20-odd games. Platini was kind of seen as a lucky general by the French. There's a bit in the book about how Bernard Lacombe, the striker, is talking about, like, whenever he went into a casino, Platini, that is, he would always win. Whenever he played rummy, he always had all the jokers, this kind of thing. When he was at Juventus, he was on the equivalent of about £300,000 a year. And that was obviously very good money by the standards of the time. About 15 years later, those kind of salaries were dwarfed by what even ordinary players were getting. There's a guy who was a substitute on the 98 World Cup team called Alan Bogossian, who played for Parma. And Platini found out that this guy was on more... He was getting paid more per month than Platini had got in a year at Juventus. And apparently this drove him mad. So you don't need to be Dr. Freud to work out why he started taking bungs under the counter and all this. It was very sad what happened to him, Platini. Like, after he got deposed from UEFA, he was invited by the organisers of Euro 2016 to come to all the games anyway. But he refused because emotionally it would have been too much for him. And apparently he hardly watched a minute of it on TV. So it was very sad. As I said, that's why I wrote the intro around him and Delaunay, because they kind of represent the two spiritual opposites of what this tournament is and what it's become.
Yeah, so, I mean, if we think then that sort of Puttini is maybe the greatest figure in the sort of history of the Euros, if you just sort of look a bit further around. So if you had to cherry pick a goal or a couple of goals and a couple of matches that you think are, you know, the greatest in the history of the Euros, what would you go for?
I've always, like, my top three would probably be in reverse order. Ronaldo against Hungary just a few years ago in Bordeaux, the one where he somehow managed to backheel it behind his own leg and in off the far post. There was another goal in that game by Zoltán Gera of Hungary, which UEFA ended up giving goal of the tournament to, and it wasn't even the best goal in that match. The second one, one that you're probably familiar with from your excellent book about Denmark, Frankie Verkouteren of Belgium scored an absolute screamer from out near the corner flag to put Belgium, I think, 2-0 up at the time, and they lost 3-2 in the end. But it was an absolutely wonderful goal. And as you were mentioning earlier, probably almost nobody in Britain has ever seen it because this thing wasn't televised properly because of England's tour of South America. And the number one, it's a very obvious choice, but it has to be Van Basten against the Soviet Union in 88. It was just one of those incredible moments. The angle was nearly impossible. Vasily Rats was right beside him, did nothing wrong. Dasayev, one of the greatest goalkeepers ever, was in goal and still went in. Dasayev is actually very sour about it, a bit like Shilton on Maradona's handball. I think there's a quote in the book from him. He said, it was a stroke of luck. Even Marco himself has said it. Give him another 100 opportunities to try it and he won't do it that way. A keeper can't be infallible. But Igor Belinov, who was playing for the USSR that day, said no one would have got that shot. If Dasayev was 5 meters tall, then maybe. But that's it. But that's easily my favourite goal of the Euros. I mean, it's a very predictable choice, but it's head and shoulders above all the others, I think.
Yeah, it's hard to look beyond that, isn't it? Because, I mean, so many goals are elevated by circumstance, I think. And you think that's in the final. He's part of quite an iconic side to have ever won the tournament, I think. And it goes past a world-class goalkeeper as well.
It's got it all, really. You know, it's in the final, the importance of it. And it killed the USSR off, pretty much, I mean, because they were coming back into the game at the time. I think it has to be that one, really.
Yeah, so in terms of matches, I mean, well, we mentioned Euro 2000 before, and I remember on the same day, actually, I think Spain-Yugoslavia, which finished 4-3, was in the afternoon, and then in the evening was a game between the Netherlands and France, which the Netherlands won 3-2. Games in one day. I mean,
two really good games. I do have a top three, and funnily enough, they're all Dutch defeats. I should say, for the record, I have nothing against the good people of the Netherlands. It's just that they've been involved in more than their fair share of great games. I would say for number three, when they lost 3-1 to Russia in 2008, and Arshavin ran the show for Russia. He was getting compared to people like Cruyff and Zidane and Laudrup after that. He was a curious player. He flickered very, very briefly, but very brightly. He was a bit of a journeyman up until he was about 26. And then for about two seasons, he was just mind-blowingly good. And then he signed for Arsenal. And yeah, he got the 4 goals against Liverpool that time, but he sort of faded away a bit after that. But that 3-1 game was astonishing. It shouldn't even have gone to extra time because Russia had chance after chance and Van der Sar kept bailing the Dutch out. My second choice, again, the Czechs beating the Netherlands 3-2 in 2004. When I was researching this game, I found out that there were 57 shots in the match, which is an extraordinary figure. And as we know, the Dutch blew it after being 2-0 up. Pavel Nedved had the game of his life. He hit the post, I think, twice. It could have ended up any score. And it was notorious as well for that appalling substitution by Dick Advocaat, where he took off Arjen Robben, who was 20 at the time, and Robben was already best player on the Dutch team. And about an hour has gone, and the Dutch are still 2-1 up. And Advocaat decides, for no apparent reason, to take off Robben and bring on Paul Bosvelt, who was like 35 years of age and not a particularly good player either. I think at one of the Netherlands' subsequent games in that tournament, there was a big banner in the stadium where their supporters were, and it said, "Dick, does your wife understand you?" And another gang of them had a whip round and paid for a plane ticket home to Amsterdam and brought it to his hotel and had it delivered by room service. So they've got a sense of humor, if nothing else. And I think for my top pick, I picked that aforementioned Italy-Netherlands game. It was, as I said, we've talked about it earlier, but even right down to the penalties where Yapstam almost cleared the stadium roof with a shot that was so wild, it was almost vertical. And seconds later, Totti comes up and does a Panenka, almost as if to say, you know, this is how you do it. There was a weird thing about Euro 2000 that I noticed. There was a weird spate of managerial resignations. Three of the coaches in the last four quit when they didn't necessarily have to. Frank Rijkaard stepped down after that Italian game. He said, it's a law that once a thing like this happens, it's time for another man to take over. And then after the other semi-final, Umberto Coelho, the Portuguese manager, he stepped down. And it was never officially said, but you would like to think it was because he was appalled by how badly his players had behaved against France, manhandling the ref and the linesman after Zidane put away that late penalty. I think Nuno Gomes was irrelevantly sent off, even though the match had already finished. And the Portuguese players chased the officials down to their dressing room and banged on the door. And then, after the final, Dino Zoff resigned as Italian manager because the well-known football guru, Silvio Berlusconi, criticised him publicly for not putting a man on Zidane, who hadn't influenced the game really anyway. Now, those were the days when managers actually resigned over points of principle, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean it's extraordinary, that tournament, actually. So I remember watching England's group match with Germany, which is a game because of the history of what had happened in the 90s. It felt like it meant everything, and turned out to mean absolutely nothing at all. It was a victory that felt massive, and then England just were completely outplayed by Romania in that final game. Felt like watching England in that tournament. And you were looking around the rest of the tournament and how other teams were playing. I mean, England just felt so far behind.
You look at the England lineups for that tournament. It's weird. You've Dennis Wise in midfield and Martin Keown at the back. You would have thought those guys would have faded out of contention by 2000, but no. It wasn't an easy group, but England they were so predictable all the time. If you snuffed out Beckham, they didn't really have anything. They had his deliveries and that was it. I think their two goals against Portugal and their winner against Germany all came from Beckham crosses, if I'm not mistaken. And they lacked, as they so often do, they lacked class. They just didn't have any answer to people like Rui Costa and Figo. And the Romania game was a howl. I remember watching it at a friend's house, and just it was like all England's big defeats rolled into one. It just had everything. Like they were one of the teams that there were no loss to the tournament because they just didn't bring anything to the party. There's a funny story about their fans, actually. Apparently for the two games, for the first game in Eindhoven, there was no trouble, and for the second game in Charleroi, there was huge-scale crowd trouble. Obviously, in Charleroi, they'd been drinking industrial-strength Belgian beer. But in Eindhoven, they couldn't get any beer, so they resorted to soft drugs instead, and they were all just wandering around. England and the Euros, in general, they have a much worse record than in the World Cup. They've never won a knockout game in the Euros, which is weird. They've drawn a few on penalties and gone out. And against Spain in 96, of course, they won. But the only time they've, if you can call a third place playoff a knockout game, which I wouldn't, against the USSR in 1968, that's the only time they've ever done it. It's a curious stat. I suspect they'll break that duck this time, because they've a decent looking team. Certainly the front half of it looks decent. And the draw has worked out for them in such a way that if they win their group and get to the final, they would play six games out of seven at Wembley. So I suspect they'll, at the very least, they'll win a proper knockout game this time.
Yeah, because I think if they win the group, I mean, the way it had been set up, they would have been playing in Dublin, I think, in the second round.
That's right, It was looking like it was going to be Germany versus England, assuming Germany won that group, which is very tough looking itself. But it's perhaps no bad thing. And this is no slight on England, but it's perhaps no bad thing that there won't be a load of them in Dublin for a big quarterfinal. I think it's 6 out of 7 now that they'll play at Wembley if all goes according to plan for them. Their group doesn't look too bad. They have, however, lost their most recent meetings with the Czechs and the Croatians. Croatia was in the World Cup semi-final, of course, and England then lost in Prague about a year and a half ago, I think it was. And of course, they almost lost the last time they played Scotland as well. Lee Griffiths with his 2 free kicks, and Harry Kane got them out of jail in the last minute. So it mightn't be as straightforward for them as they think, but there's no doubt they have an overabundance of very good young attackers.
So just thinking about the tournament in the present day, then, as we're talking about it now, I mean, where do you think the Euro sits in the football calendar? Because as you mentioned earlier, it's the third biggest sports tournament in the world now after the Olympics and the World Cup. I think in some kind of cocktail of like revenue and viewing figures, they work that out. So it's become this enormous event. But then you also hear things like the World Cup maybe going to being staged every 2 years, things like that. They've now got the Nations League that's attached to the Euros as well. I mean, what future do you see for the tournament, really? Do you think they'll expand it again? Do you think they'll go to 32 teams?
Well, when you're dealing with FIFA and UEFA, I mean, literally anything could happen. They seem totally unaware of the non-financial value of these events and too aware of the financial value. They're squeezing until the pips squeak, really. They're just, all these expansions, it cannot do anything but dilute the quality. I mean, you saw it in 2016. There were very few good games, and there were so many games. I remember sort of midway through the second round, which had 8 matches, 16 teams, obviously, and just thinking, like, Christ, there's another 20-odd matches of this thing to go. And not looking forward to it. And if they're losing people like me, then they're losing lots of people. Now, it'll always have a certain cachet, a certain status, but they really are doing their best to break it. The World Cup, again, is another matter. This 48 teams thing, I can't see how that's possibly going to work in terms of giving us a good competition. With the Euros, they can't really expand it much more past 24. If you had 32 teams in it, that would solve the sort of square root problem and get rid of the third place teams thing. But there's probably only about 9 or 10 good teams in Europe. Not even, if you keep letting everyone in, like you just end up with a very weak brew, you know? There's also the fact that a lot of the standard, like in the 80s, you could say international football was nearly a better standard than, say, the top levels of club football. If you look at the big European Cup games in the 80s, and then look at the big internationals in the 80s. The internationals are way better, way more entertaining, more skill. Players really giving it loads. Now the Champions League is turned into this thing where 7 or 8 clubs have all the best players. And while that makes for a dreadful competition in lots of ways, it does mean that the big quarters and semi-finals are usually of a very high standard, even if it's the same old teams winning all the time. The World Cup, I mean, I think we started seeing the first sort of stirrings of players not giving so much of a hoot about it as before in 2002. Everyone turned up fatigued. Players like Vieira and Scholes had played 60-odd games in the season. They were on their last legs. It is then I sort of started getting the sense that maybe to some of these guys, it doesn't matter so much anymore. You can see it with someone like Thierry Henry, who I know he ended up as the top scorer for France historically for the national team. But with the possible exception of Euro 2000, there was never a tournament where he took things by the scruff of the neck, because tournament football really is shit or bust. You know, you don't get the, if you miss a sitter in a huge game, you don't get the chance to put it right against Aston Villa the following weekend. You know, you're gone. And someone like Henry, who always struck me as, like, you'd see him before games, he'd be, and after games, even if they'd lost. Like, I mean, when the French got thrashed by the Dutch in Basel in 2008, afterwards, there's Henri, like, laughing and joking with people like Van Persie. And that went down really, really badly with a lot of people. It's kind of forgotten now, but at the time I remember there was a bit of a stink about it. So it's possible some of these players, maybe they see international football as, you know, this kind of curious adjunct of their careers, but not hardly the be-all and end-all. And some of that's down to finance and money. But I just, at the moment, like with all these endless reorganizations of the tournaments, it just feels like there's a tipping point coming. Maybe we'll see it this year. Like, I think, like, having 36 games to get rid of 8 teams out of 24 is ludicrous. Sporting wise, it's ludicrous. Mathematically, it's ludicrous as well. It would be wonderful if they went back to just 16 teams, but let's face it, that's never going to happen because they've 20 extra games now to reap more TV cash and match day receipts from. So I suppose we're stuck with 24 teams for the foreseeable long-term future.
So what are your, I'll just finish with a final question. What are your thoughts on the upcoming rescheduled Euros? So everything's been delayed by a year, and obviously the idea to spread it all across Europe, I think across 16 countries in total, isn't it? Now in the face of COVID, as you know, it's not going to be the kind of continent-wide jamboree that they were hoping for. I mean, what are your expectations this summer for the tournament?
Well, it's going to be a weird one. I mean, with so few fans in the stadium, I mean, having 10,000 people there or so, it will make a difference and it will be better. But it's going to be a curious one. I mean, we've no idea of knowing how it'll all play out until it actually happens, obviously. But I think, especially if there's an unexpected winner, if a team comes from nowhere and wins it, I suspect it'll always go down as this sort of slightly weird mutant Euros, not like the rest. You know what I mean? It'll always have some kind of a little weird asterisk beside it. It'll depend who wins. I mean, if it's a straightforward win for someone like Germany or France, then maybe that perception will be different. But if someone like, I don't know, let's say Russia or someone, or someone who wouldn't normally, well, actually maybe Russia are not the best example. I think it'll be a Euros like no other in terms of like having the stadiums only at, you know, quarter capacity or whatever, that has to do something to the players. Will the sense of occasion be diminished? Who knows? We're not really going to know until it all actually unfolds. I am looking forward to it, but not as much as I normally would be. Partly because the last one was, for the most part, so dreary that it just really showed up the folly of expanding the tournament so much. I'm sure we'll, like, even the bad tournaments will throw up at least a dozen moments of drama or talking points or whatever. Even the very worst ones in history have done that. But am I expecting this one to be really good? No. There doesn't seem to be a really outstanding national team around at the moment anyway. There seems to be a lot of okay, middling teams. That might make for closer contests and all that. But another thing as well, VAR was used at the last World Cup, and to most people's surprise, it worked very well because it wasn't rubbing out goals for, you know, someone's fingernail being a millimeter beyond someone's ear or whatever. I hope that when we see VAR in this thing, it'll be run along the same lines. It'll only be used for really, really big calls and not the atrocities we've been seeing in the Premier League for the last year or so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you will have to write about this tournament one day, I suppose, when you do your revised chapter for a new edition of the book. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the draw has been interesting. Group F, I think it is, the final group. What's it? Portugal, Germany, France, and Hungary. That's three of the semi-finalists from last time, and a team that also got to the last 16. Funny, if I was talking to somebody the other day about this, and he says he's convinced Hungary will not finish bottom. In other words, he reckons one of the big three to have a total meltdown. But we'll see what happens. Looking at the other groups, I'd be intrigued to see if Finland can do anything, because this is their very first time at a tournament. They never I think they only ever came close once before. That was Euro 2008. They needed to win in Porto to get through, and they drew nil all. Roy Hodgson was the manager actually back then, funnily enough. So it'll be intriguing to see how they get on. They have a big grudge match in their second game, I think it is, against Russia. There's no love lost there at all, to put it mildly. So might be worth keeping an eye on that one.
And as a very final question, I mean, if you were going to put money anywhere on a winner, I mean, who do you fancy for it this summer?
Well, there's a lot of talk about England, for obvious reasons. Germany could go either way. Love has said he's going. Usually that doesn't help a team's form. Sometimes it does. Nobody is talking about Portugal. You've got Ronaldo on his mad one-man mission to obliterate Ali Dai's international scoring record. You've got Bruno Fernandes, although he's there's question marks about how much he has left in the tank after Man United's long season. And they've got a lot of good defenders. They're in a group, which means they're going to really have to hit the ground running. They can't just sleepwalk into their first match. And of course, they are the reigning champions, and they're not the reigning champions for nothing, you know. So yeah. I think nobody seems to fancy them at all, but I think they'd be worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah, I quite fancy. Well, I find it hard to look beyond France, but I saw them the kind of rejigged new Spain team thrash Germany. I think it's back in November now. They've beaten 6-0, but they look like they might have something going there with some kind of really good young players in the front six now. So one of those two for me, I think.
Yeah, Spain have a, wouldn't call it an easy group, but it doesn't look particularly testing. It's three middling sort of opponents. I think it's Sweden, Slovakia, and Poland. So that could give them a good launch pad into the knockout stages. However, I was looking at their squad. There's a lot of decent players in it, but there's no Iniesta type figure. There's no David Villa type figure, really. It's a lot of players who are all pretty handy, but as a collective, do they have the right stuff to coalesce together and do something special? Like for quite a while now, Spain have been just another team. The aura of invincibility is long gone. Louis van Gaal knocked it out of them in 2014 at the World Cup, and it's never come back. So it'll be interesting to see what they do.
Yeah, well, we'll see what it adds to the great sort of canon of European Championship stories. So thanks very much for your time today, Jonathan. Quick reminder for listeners. Jonathan's book's called Euro Summits, the story of the UEFA European Championship 1960 to 2016, and is available now from Pitch Publishing. Jonathan, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Michael.
Social Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.